Welcome to an abbreviated after hours, because we will get to the Bears post game at 10:30. But in the meantime, and the game I've been watching, and I'm a big football fan, was pretty boring so far. So, you know, you can replay it, or you can listen to the show later at your convenience. That's the joy of modern radio. Ben Anderson's in there producing, and Adam Phillips, one of the world's greatest engineers, a legend at this station, is in there engineering, so this show will go more smoothly than ever. It is a treat, once again, to have William Hazelgrove in here to talk about his latest book. He is one of the most talented and prolific writers in this area. This latest book, I got to tell you, Bill, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I said, okay, Wright Brothers, wrong story. I said to myself, well, now, wait a minute, Rick, you certainly know who the Wright Brothers are, and indeed, you may have read a book titled The Wright Brothers by David McCullough, who is an eminent historian. You obviously read that book, too.
I did, and actually that led to this book.
How so, Bill?
I was actually on a ship reading it, and I love David McCullough, fantastic historian.
Oh, no question.
1776 and Sam Adams, fantastic. But when I read the Wright Brothers book, it left me cold, and for this reason, I felt this was the same old story I'd heard my whole life, these sort of sawdust characters leaking sawdust at every turn, you know, no bodily fluids, just these sort of mannequins going through life with their derbies, the high collars, you know, they become fascinated with flight, they're co-joined at the hip, they go down and invent the airplane. 1903, end of story. And that's sort of been the story that's been handed down to history and remained intact.
You know, I'm a writer too, we have to blame the original biographer of the Wright Brothers. We'll get to him. We'll get to him. He is a strange fellow named Fred Kelly.
Yes.
Strange in a million different ways.
Yes.
He smoked cigarette, drank like thousands of cups of coffee every day. When you started digging into these characters, I find them, Bill, in your book, Wright Brothers, Wrong Story. I don't know if I'm going to call them flawed, but I call them among the most interesting brothers with a... this is also, ladies and gentlemen, a very, not quite Eugene O'Neill-esque family history. This is a very, very odd family in which they are born and raised.
Truly. Very insular. Bishop Milton sort of sets the cast, and he says, the world outside is evil. Present a united front. Trust no one outside the family. So Wilbur, Orville, Catherine, nobody leaves the family home. Everybody drops out of high school, by the way. Nobody marries until Catherine does much later in her 50s, and that's another story. But in this very insular household, basically the distrust of the world outside will play into the Wright myth in this sort of cementing of the view of the world and presenting this sort of mythology to the world and never really saying it. And of course, Bishop Milton was always traveling. He could actually go out and go enjoy the free world, but he wanted his home life to remain the same.
They were indeed smart kids. I mean, Wilbur, and if I get them confused, unconfuse me, Wilbur was on his way to a scholarship or at least to 4 years at Yale University, and something terrible happened to him, but you make the case that that something terrible really almost enabled him to invent the airplane, to put it simply.
Yes, a man, or boy man, named Oliver Crook Hall changed history, actually. They're 17, Wilbur's on his way to Yale. They're playing hockey. Oliver Crookhaw is a little high on cocaine tooth drops and other drugs. Comes up, smashes his jaw. And this is the time when one malady leads to another. He goes into a 3-year depression. His mother's dying at the same time. He doesn't leave the house. It's during this time that Wilbur's life changes entirely. Yale is out the door, and he takes on flight. This is when the genesis of I'm going to go solve flight. You're talking about a man who's only been a bike mechanic and had a small print shop and has only lived at home. Basically, be like your eyes saying, we're going to go fly to the moon.
Yeah, but even we have some idea of the moon. And
right.
We would have seen a rocket ship somewhere. This seemed to come, one of the fascinating things, it was not as if every daily newspaper was publishing, hey, another guy tried to fly, another guy, you have
right.
Icarus.
Right.
Is basically your example.
Well, exactly. And basically, he started to read all of the books in Bishop Milton's library, And this is why it was sort of his raison d'etre. This is why, you know, when I began the book of research, I did not start out to say Wilbur Wright was the man who flew.
Sure.
I found this through the letters and papers of Wilbur and Orville Wright, which was about 2 feet tall, as I read through it. And it quickly it came to me that at this point, he took on flight. It became his quest of life at this point.
Do you think that was a serendipitous discovery? Because, I mean, obviously his dad had some kind of books in the library. Had those books not been there,
Truly it could be. There was one on animal flight, which, of course, he started to base it on birds. Also, there was a man called the Flying Man who died at this time, who was a German who would jump off the side of cliffs with his wings. And Wilbur was following him. And then when he died, this really hit him. Otto Lithgow, I think his name was. It really hit him. And from then on, he really took that on. And again, with no training at all. And of course, he's the one then, to jump a little bit ahead, he's the one who contacted Smithsonian.
Right.
And where Samuel Langley had his man Rathbone send him all the documents.
Well, he literally, basically wrote the Smithsonian a letter saying, "Hi, I'm this kid, and I would like to have every document you have,"
right,
"or any studies or surveys,"
right,
"that you have done about man's attempt to fly."
Exactly. And you know, and they responded and sent it to him. And then, of course, he took that, and then he also reached out to somebody else, Octave Chanute. And Octave Chanute was his aeronautical scientist of his time. So this bike mechanic says that Octave Chanute, "I have several theories I'm going to pursue, and, you know, I want to know what you know."
And that was the first of a long series of letters.
Yeah. So this began 500 letters. And this, not to jump too far ahead.
No, jump around.
This is where the head-cracking physics of flight occurred between these two men. It wasn't between Wilbur and Orville. It was between Octave Chanute and Wilbur. And here, if you read these, you know, you can't understand the math, because what happens here is the lift coefficients were all wrong on every wing. All the basic data was wrong. All these men were jumping off the side of cliffs with wings, doing all sorts of things. They fly for a little bit and they kill themselves. This is because nobody took on this science. A man named Sam Langley, who's the secretary of the Smithsonian, he had some success. He was the anointed one. He had a little steam engine flyer, we'll call it a steam bug, that took off, flew around the Potomac off a boat called the Ark a couple times. He and Alexander Graham Bell are on the boat. They look at it and they go, "My God, flight." The government says, "Sure, here's $50,000. And to Langley's mind, he's saying, "I'll just build a bigger one and put a man in it. We'll be absolutely fine." And they had, this is where Wilbur's genius comes through. Wilbur had a theory at the very early point that flight was inherently unstable. Langley believed it was like a locomotive, that you could go straight down the track, and if you went in the air, it would continue straight. Wilbur said, "No, you can't continue straight, that it's unstable, and that's why it's a control system that you have to have."
This is one of the most fascinating. It's fascinating on a million different levels, and now we're talking a little technical stuff, but it is also fascinating, Wright Brothers' wrong story, as a human story, as a family story, as a dysfunction story. And we add into that dysfunction Fred Kelly, a biographer, non-parent. That is the piano of Joe Alterman from a new CD of his called, oddly, it's a terrible title for a jazz, very accomplished jazz CD, More Cornbread. There may be some incredible mystery in that. There is no mystery to the Wright brothers after reading Wright Brothers' Wrong Story, how Wilbur Wright solved the problem of manned flight. You do not, on the handsome cover of William Hazelgrove's latest book, you see a picture of Orville Wright, but you don't see his name. What was Orville doing while Wilbur was kind of corresponding with people who shared his passion and for the mystery of flight?
Well, Orville was busy with the bike shop. I mean, Orville was much more of a businessman. Wilbur had written his father early on and said, "I do not like business.
I want to go to Yale.
Yeah, and I don't like this competition. I like the life of the mind." And he thought about teaching. So while Wilbur is contacting Octave Chanute,
the Smithsonian,
and then the Weather Bureau, And he does something very interesting. And this is all on his own. This is what people don't understand. He's doing this on his own. He takes a box, an inner tube box, and starts to flex it. And he starts to come up with the concept of wing warping. We call them ailerons today. And he noticed with birds that they flex the tip of their wing, and that's how they turn. So he makes a kite. He goes outside of Dayton, Ohio, with two strings on each end. He flies it by himself and uses wing warping for the first time, making the kite fly. This is the basic of control that has not changed till today.
Wow.
So then, after he contacts the National Weather Bureau and says, you know, the winds in Kitty Hawk are constant. This is a good place to go. After he's contacted Octave Chanute and Smithsonian, he builds his glider. You know, does Orville help him build the glider? Probably. You know, Orville is a gifted mechanic, so he probably did help him. But he takes the glider. He then ships it down to Kitty Hawk.
Exactly, by himself. He does that.
And then he goes down to Kitty Hawk by himself. And again, you know, history just sort of covers us all up. And he writes his father before he goes, using the singular I want to fly. I have built a flying machine. I will not kill myself in North Carolina, I do not think. You know, so he's speaking, saying it is his vision. So he goes down there, and he nearly kills himself trying to get there because he has to get across Albemarle Sound in a gale and barely makes it. Goes down there, and he sets up camp where Orville later joins him.
Orville joined him in part because their father, was it his, the father said, hey, go help your brother or something?
Yeah, well, the father was also very much to Wilbur, take care of your brother. So he comes down there as the little brother. And you know, and Orville, and Bishop Wright was very adamant about this equal credit, but he also revealed himself in a letter to Orville where he said, be careful, do not risk your life. Orville is nothing without you. It's a very brutal letter. He said, you are the one who, you know, has to be here for the aeronautical world. He said the same letter to Catherine, where he said, Wilbur is the most important. You know, the bishop was a real cold fish in a way.
Let's talk for a second about the ever-intriguing Catherine, who was indeed biologically a sister, but actually almost a mother.
Yes,
and,
yes.
Almost, and oddly... I'm telling you, people, that the family story of the Wright family is wrong in so many different ways. She's also kind of like the wife mother.
Well, yeah, the bishop turns him into his dead wife and basically says to her, you take care of the family and take care of your brothers, which she does. And her primary relationship is with women. Today, would she be bisexual? Possibly. It's it's almost blasphemous to say anything about the rights like this that brings him into the 20th century. But, you know, what's Orville like? Orville's more like a metrosexual. He's very concerned about his appearance. He always wants, you know, very colorful socks. When he comes back from Kitty Hawk, he bleaches his face to turn it white again. He's constantly making sure his hands are clean. There was a kid who shined his shoes who actually made another discovery about Orville, and he would say that Mr. Wright would take the shoes and examine them meticulously every time he shined them. He's very different. Wilbur was much more rugged man, personally. He didn't mind if he was sort of scuffy, you know. And Wilbur was a sort of malcontent, a misanthrope. He was, people would make comments about him, like, if you got three words out of Wilbur, you were lucky.
Were they, Bill, in your estimation? You don't make it a hard case here, and I think probably one of the reasons that they were grouped together is this kind of, and we'll get to this crazy biographer who is, I think, responsible for this kind of thing, that it made a better story for these men to be these courageous, kind of heroic, and I will say manly figures, you know, the risking death kind of thing. These are right. Real men. And that no one looked beyond that surface except people who knew them.
Absolutely. Well, also, too, in America, we love teamwork.
Yeah.
You know, we're a very egalitarian society where nobody is, in theory, more talented than the next. So it's a much better story to say these two brothers worked together and created something. But we know, every writer knows, every composer knows, every architect knows that there's a guiding force. There is someone with a vision who is able. Because what Wilbur did was he took a lot of the known, and then he took the unknown when he built his wind tunnel and had to rewrite all the data tables on lift. And he had to take that in a sort of artist sense and bend it and then go, control is everything. And by the way, his patent is not for an airplane, it's for a control system, elevator, rudder, aileron,
right,
that's used in every plane today.
That's really astonishing. Ben Anderson, the producer of this show, is a huge aeronautics fan and goes to these incredible air shows where you should start appearing. You know, Ben, Ben, he's not listening. Ben, I'm talking about you on the radio. You should take this book to all of your aeronautics shows and sell it and split the proceeds. I mean, this is this story is, and I assume that everybody who is at an aeronautic show, especially the kind Ben goes to with older planes, thinks of these people as godlike, the yes. Wright brothers. I mean, they're revered without any hesitation, right?
To a degree. There are people, if you read the reviews on the back, who are aeronautic giants, and there is some pushback on that in the big dispute that actually happened with the Smithsonian during Orville, when, you know, Wilbur, we might as well get this out there. Wilbur dies in 1912. Orville lives till 1948. The first chapter of my book's called The Wright Myth. The reason The Wright Myth began was because of this discrepancy where no biography was written for a very long time. Charles Lindbergh got in on it.
Right,
and said,
Lindbergh wanted to
yeah,
do
yeah, he said, and he also said, look, you've got to write a biography or have somebody write one to Orville. Orville said, no, until Fred Kelly came along, who was a very good friend of his.
Yeah.
Very good friend. But even still, Orville was very reluctant, and he finally said, you can write a biography, but I will approve every page.
Right.
And by the way, the in the biography, Orville's name appears about 500 times. Wilbur's appears about 300 times.
Oh, you
times.
Have the exact number in there.
Yes,
do.
I do.
That's the kind of research you did. And about Fred Kelly, in the chapter one, the biographer, this is how it begins, and this is why this book by my friend William Hazelgrove, Wright Brothers, Wrong Story, go to williamhazelgrove.com and you will see all of his books, some of which we'll talk about after the break in the news at 9:30. But he is a tireless researcher and writes with the dramatic force of a great novelist. This chapter begins, Fred C. Kelly smoked and drank his coffee cold. Awful. Cigarettes and coffee kept him going, usually, but he felt fatigue that even nicotine and caffeine couldn't mitigate. He lit another cigarette and blew the smoke out, blah, and on and on and on. It is a marvelous book. We got to take a commercial break now, get some news, and I'll continue on with the Bill Hazelgrove talking about, oh, we didn't really hit, we're going to hit very hard, Sister Catherine, Sister Mother Catherine, and a little more about Fred Kelly. We'll be right back. First, I'll tell you, though, I don't even tell you. Here come some commercials. That's why I heard those people clapping this CD by Joe Alterman, More Cornbread, was recorded live. He's a good jazz player. He's only been in Chicago a couple times. He was here this weekend, actually, playing at Winter's Jazz Club. William Hazelgrove will be at a number of Barnes & Noble stores, a couple other stores over the next few weeks, allowing you to meet him and buy Wright Brothers' Wrong Story and thereby be the hit of any Christmas or, well, Hanukkah's over, but any Christmas or Kwanzaa party you're going to, by giving anybody who's interested in history this book, because it is fascinating, it's compelling, it's exciting, and it's dark, too, I think. It's dark. During those years, Bill, I think it's an incredible family story that has really never been told accurately before because of a joker named Fred Kelly. Was he determined, Bill, to just honor Orville, and Orville was, you know, wanted to see every page and obviously oversaw every single word of this thing? Was he insecure? What was his motivation? The brothers, they can't make a guess.
He was always the little brother.
Yeah.
Wilbur was the dominant intellect building this plane. So Wilbur dies in 1912. So in all this time, he doesn't have the biography. Finally, he says, okay, you can do it. He has a secretary, too, named Mabel Beck. and nobody can get to Orville unless they went through Mabel Beck. So Fred Kelly actually had to go through Mabel to get information. And then he would send the pages, and Orville would go over them. So he was very concerned that history would get it right. His view, and by the way, the name of the biography, when it is finally published in 1942, is The Wright Brothers, a biography authorized by Orville Wright.
Wow. Wow, that's right. That's right. That's right. The Wright Brothers, that is such a part of Americana.
Right.
Such a part of Americana.
Right, and so this Bible, if you will, that was published then, which this actually was all tangled up in the Smithsonian dispute as well, comes out, and this is lays the groundwork for the Wright myth, which says they are the same. They are joined at the hip. Everything they did was the same. And in fact, if you read the Fred Kelly's biography, you come away with Orville's story of everything,
yeah,
not Wilbur's. So yeah, this is where the first, you know, covering of history took place.
When you finished your research, you knew you were onto something, did you not? You really must have. And you probably knew or thought that, well, you know, some people are going to rap me for this kind of thing. Instead, that may have happened, I don't know about it. Instead, the Smithsonian, which was sort of responsible in many ways for the Wright brothers, has published a piece.
Yes.
Lauding this book.
Right. Right, right, right. Actually, the Smithsonian approached me to write about the 1903 propeller that is in the Smithsonian, and so it came out in the Smithsonian magazine. So as you said, they're in the middle of this story because Wilbur gets in a dispute with them where they come back and they say, look, really Samuel Langley's plane could have flown. Orville says, absolutely not, and if you say that, you keep saying that, I'm going to send the plane away. They call his bluff. He ships the 1903 flyer that flew the first 12 seconds of powered flight. He ships that away for 20 years to Britain, to London. It goes all the way through the Blitzkrieg, way underground. So the Germans are bombing this plane with the very technology that was developed below them.
Okay? Amazing. Was this a joyful... I know the writing was probably joyful for you, but the research, was it joyful? You know, when you come upon things like this, you I guess you must feel that you've come upon a kind of a secret.
Yeah, you come. It's a diamond in the darkness, certainly. And of course, I used all their letters and diaries, and people will reveal themselves in the letters. You know, you read the secondary sources, but that's somebody else's, you know, interpretation. But when you read the letters, what revealed itself was that Wilbur had done this. You know, Wilbur had cracked the science of flight. Also, too, in the letters, there's a lot about the famous photograph from 1903.
Right.
And this is the thing that also skewed history. They do a coin toss, December 14th, Wilbur flies first. It goes up and down. Orville's turn on December 17th, 25 degrees out, 34-mile-an-hour wind, Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Orville flies for 12 seconds, which is up and down. Okay. John Tate, over the big box camera, takes the photo. They don't even know this photo exists. Then Wilbur flies for a full minute with full control. This is the first real moment of controlled flight. But the photo is developed, and everybody sees that with Orville in the plane.
Sure.
So this cements this myth of, oh, Orville was the man who invented flight, because here he is flying.
December 17th was the date. Bill, you continue to amaze me. I mean, you've been one of my favorite writers for a long time, and I always, every time I'm thinking, wow, I wonder when Bill's going to have a new book, it arrives on my desk, and it's better than the last book. I mean, the last two, and I do go, because you want to find out where he's going to be over the next few weeks. Go to William Hazelgrove. I'm not going to insult you by spelling it for you, WilliamHazelgrove.com, because he's going to be around, and you will also be able to buy his... He started as a novelist, this man, working in Hemingway's old place in Oak Park.
Yes.
And then I've written about, you can also Google the two of us, William Hazelgrove and Rick Kogan, to find a couple pieces I've done about, I'll tell you this, the first woman president, yes, there was one, and Teddy Roosevelt, almost without a doubt, the most amazing, and a present company included, the most amazing president this country has ever had.
Agreed.
As a human being.
Agreed.
I think, as a human being. Bill, happy holidays. Thank you for coming in, and can't wait for the next one.
It's actually on Sally Rand, just to give you your...
It is?
Yes. Yeah, it's actually done.
Sally Rand, I'll tell you one quick Sally Rand story. When my father and I were doing a book called Yesterday Chicago, which was a pictorial history of Chicago, I was very young, and my chore was to go out and talk to old press photographers to see what they had in their closets and their basements and their attics, photographs that had never appeared in the papers when they worked for the papers. And there's a stunning shot of Sally Rand in a hotel room. She's not naked, but she's behind a screen. And I'll never forget this 85-year-old guy telling me a story for an hour about she was really beautiful. I think I saw part of her naked, Mr. Kogan. I'm 19. Sally Rand is influential. I just wrote about Sally Rand. I can't wait for that one, Phil. So you're going to tell me what's the tip? Sally Rand was actually a man. Just don't tell me,
right?
Because you always have something.
Right. Always have something.
You always have something. It's a pleasure to see you again, and I can't wait for the next one. And sell a million of this. The book is Wright Brothers. Wrong Story, How Wilbur Wright Solved the Problem of Man Flight, and How a Crazy, Crooked Biographer Invented the Wright Brothers, giving too much Wilbur's the guy who deserves most
truly
credit.
Truly.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
Jazz may not be the appropriate lead-in for this segment. It'd be more like the fiddle playing. But around the holidays, as you know, you were asked to, you know, contribute to this, contribute to that, contribute to some unfortunate trouble in the world. I suggest that you contribute to the first annual fundraiser for Music, Films, and Culture. This is another in the endless series of wonderful ideas by Mike Houlihan. Mike, how are you?
Thanks, Rick. I love that intro.
Well, I mean that. I mean, it's always, you know, at this time of year, people are always put upon to, oh, you know, help the people less fortunate than you are and blah, blah, blah. There are a lot of good things out there that need support. And what you have been doing over more, you've been doing for, you know, nearly half a century in show business, you know, that is worthwhile too. I mean, culture is as important a thread in the fabric of life as, I think, literally, as health. How did this?
I agree. I think culture is
yes,
the arc of the divine.
Yes, and especially around the holidays too. Yeah. To sort of do something that enlivens the soul and doesn't so much guilt trip people. It's being held Sunday, this coming Sunday, from 3 to 7 at the Hilton Chicago, scene of a famous riot in front of it many, many years ago.
1968.
Yes,
man.
I was there. But this is in a much more sedate affair in the Boulevard Room. How did this idea come to be, Mike? I mean, when did you think, you know, I'm going to have a fundraiser?
Well, it's also my birthday, my 70th birthday, and I thought, well, what better reason to celebrate than my birthday? So that's where it started, and I even got my family involved. My sons both work with me, and Skinny and I were looking for a way to, he's going to be leaving the show at the end of the year, so we thought that would be another way to celebrate.
This is the 10th anniversary of one of Chicago's most remarkable radio shows, with two of the most ebullient hosts in the history of Chicago radio.
Actually, it's only 9 years, but we figured out, because we looked it up today.
So you have.
And he says it only seems like 10 minutes underwater.
Why did you guys? Remind me when you started the show and why. I mean, you're both ebullient personalities, and it was like, okay, we can't just sit in a couple of bar stools and talk to each other. We need to share ourselves with the world.
You know what? We were on an Irish radio show one day, and we were both promoting different things.
Yeah.
And we kind of went after each other, making wisecracks, and somebody suggested, you guys should have your show. And the interesting thing about the show, Skinny taught me so much, was we couldn't just sit sit there and gab. And
So
we kind of honed in on Irish culture. Met a lot of great musicians and singers and fiddlers, as you say.
Yeah.
And that's how we came up with the Irish angle and became Ethnic Radio.
Well, and then, you know, that is expanded. Before we get to your the thing that is dear to my heart, the Irish-American movie Hooli, of which I am the official chronicler.
You are.
I know. Well, yeah. I thought it was a remarkable thing. You started it. This is the fifth year of that.
It'll be fifth next year, yeah.
It'll be that. And you started that basically because you realized there was no such thing as an Irish-American movie festival. And, Mike, I got to tell you, over the years, some of the best movies I've seen were part of that festival. They are just, and I would have never had a chance to see them anywhere else.
And you know what? Thanks to you, it's thriving now. It's just doing great. So.
Well, I'm glad. And you also have, there's the Hooli's Hooli, you have a way with words. The Hooli's Hooli.
Well, Hooli is a party.
Radio show. Oh, I know. You think I don't know that? I mean, I couldn't figure out with the first Irish-American movie, Hooli. But also, your kids have a radio show. Now, the Craic, is that how you say it?
The Craic.
Craic, yeah. Radio show. I'm not terribly familiar with that. What is that?
That's me and Gino Cooney, the funniest undertaker in Chicago.
Okay.
And we do it now from Chief O'Neill's over on
Elston
Avenue.
Yeah, that's a nice
place.
And it's
all about traditional Irish music. We have some of the greatest legendary Irish musicians from all over the world play there on our show, which is a lot of fun.
You're also celebrating the trips that you and Mr. Sheehan have taken to Ireland, which are, in a certain segment of Chicago, about the most legendary excursions. It's like people going to Brigadoon.
Oh, a Ken Kesey thing going. It's a great trip. Seven times. We've been there seven times.
And with a bigger crowd each time?
Yeah, we've had as many as 50 people on the bus with us, just going from site to site, bar to bar, pub to pub.
And you've all kept
I have to recover. It takes me 2 weeks.
Yeah, I know. I can imagine. You've all kept your sanity, and I suppose you all still have your livers intact, yes? Yes?
Yeah, recover.
Talking about that, this thing, it is going to be a celebration. You're going to have the movies are going to be screened on some kind of big screen TV, right?
Yeah, we'll be playing them like continuously.
And you've got such performers as two of my all-time favorites, Catherine O'Connell and Patty Homan. They'll be performing, right?
Yes, Katie and Larry Nugent and Pat Quinn, Liam Durk and Teresa Chan. We've got over a dozen great Irish performers.
And you think they're all going to, at one point, certainly everybody's going to break into Happy Birthday, don't you think?
Well, more importantly, I think they're going to be doing a lot of Christmas carols and stuff like that.
How nice. Is there going to be food?
There will be corned beef sandwiches.
What else? What else?
Hit the bar for your other nourishment.
Well, but that's as it should be. This could become something of a holiday tradition.
Well, that's what I'm telling my kids, because I said, you know what? After I'm dead, you guys can be throwing the same fundraiser on my birthday after I'm gone.
There's a charming thought for a person's 70th birthday party.
Let me give a shout out to my pals at Riley's Daughter. I was out there today selling my book, so I want to say hi to Brendan and Boz O'Brien.
This all operates under the HibernianTransmedia.org. Can you spell that, ladies and gentlemen? I'm sure you can. Look up, just Google Mike Houlihan, and you'll find all the information to this. Or
yes,
don't you think?
That's the best way to do it. Just Google me.
There's a suggested donation of $100. You can donate online to this thing. It is, to my mind, you know, I've watched, and we've both watched, the Irish-American Heritage Society, you know, be born and thrive. And I think that too often the Irish contribution, I'm half Irish, to American culture is somehow overlooked. And I rail about the whole kiss me, I'm Irish, St. Patrick's Day nonsense that takes place here. And there's a deeper, much more profound meaning to it all, even though it's Mike Houlihan, the most youthful 70-year-old I've ever
known. I had my cultural epiphany maybe 6 years ago. The president of Ireland was in town, Michael Higgins, And he gave a speech about culture, and he said it was a living, breathing thing, constantly changing and morphing into an ever-evolving celebration of the society that creates it. And I said, that's it, you know?
Well, and it's also something, I think, and I'm talking at the beginning of this segment, that it's something that needs to be nourished, too.
Yes.
It cannot exist in a kind of vacuum. It cannot exist one day a year with a with a parade, and then another day, and green beer is not exactly the way to do it. Now, Skinny is Mr. Sheehan is leaving the radio show to pursue. Well, he's done it. You know, 9 years is a long time, and somebody probably pushing 1,000 guests.
I learned a lot from Skinny.
Oh, he's
one of the things I learned was how to keep my mouth shut.
Well, he's spent a lot
still working
of time
on it, though.
He's spent a lot of time in politics. You getting any nibbles to work in anybody's campaign for this?
You know what? I've got press credentials, and I'm just looking at this circus and thinking, I'm going to just jump in and right after the first of the year and start checking it all out because it's going to be insane.
Well, because the last book you wrote, when you got involved in Chuy Garcia's campaign during the last election, the book you wrote about it was, I thought it was sensational because it was it was among the most. You didn't owe anybody. You didn't owe anybody. You could tell it.
Still don't owe anybody.
That's true.
Maybe you.
You don't owe me anything. Yeah, I should run for mayor. But you
Why
told
not everybody else's.
You told it in such an unvarnished way, and such a. You also know the way this city works, Mike Houlihan, for good and evil, if I can say it that way.
That's the perfect word.
Yeah, yeah. So if go to, ladies and gentlemen, you can go to Hibernian Transmedia.org. Or you can just, I suppose, you can pay at the gate and just show up next.
You can pay at the gate, or you can reserve a spot. You can RSVP. Just send an email to my son, PattyHoulihan10@gmail.com.
How many people are you expecting for this?
I'm hoping hundreds.
Yeah, of course you're hoping. How many you expect?
I don't know, maybe 150, 200.
Oh, that'd be charming, Mike. You deserve it. I'm going to do my best to be there, I think.
Oh, we'd love to have you.
Yeah, I would love to be there. And
the crack will be mighty, I can guarantee you
that. Well, the lovely Kathy Murray, I would love, she's never met you face-to-face.
Oh, good. She knows
She knows Skinny pretty well, and she goes, I used to go east on 57th Street at the Beverly Arts Center. I saw it 4 times with my mom, and I'm thinking, okay, well, you need to meet Mike.
Oh, she started going east on Ashland. Oh,
east on
great.
Ashland, that's it. That's it, east on Ashland. She saw it for like 4 times. Her mother was in love with
God
it.
Bless her.
It and you. Mike, I hope this is a huge success. I also hope to see you there. We're celebrating 9 or 10 years of the Skinny and Hooley Show,
right.
5 years of the Irish-American movie Hooley, 4 years of Hooley's Hooley radio show, 3 years of the Crake radio show, some upcoming thing that I need to know about our Irish Pub TV, and 70 years in the life of one of the most creative people Chicago has ever known, Mike Cohen.
Thank you. God bless
My
you,
pleasure.
Rick.
God, well, I don't often say God bless you, but happy holidays, and I'll see you on Sunday.
Okay, thanks.
Mike, thanks a million. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We will, after the news, talk to the one and only Dana Montana, who runs a number of ventures in Lake Geneva, among them the Dancing Horses, which has a special holiday show. And I will play you, I will allow Adam Phillips to choose a tune or two from this CD I gave him, because he's one of the great musical minds of this century, and we'll play you an entire song. What's a Bears score? Roger.
15-6 there.
15-6. How exciting. How exciting. How unbelievable exciting. Welcome back. This is After Hours. And understandably, if you are listening to this show and watching the Bears game at the same time, I can totally understand. Because when and if they win this game, it is going to be Bears fever here like crazy. But I do want to tell you, because the Bears don't play 24 hours a day, that you have some time on your hands. And one of the things that is, to my mind, one of the great holiday experiences, we're trying to get the person who runs the show, Dana Montana, on the phone to talk about it. But her Dancing Horses show, just outside of Lake Geneva, is one of the Midwest's... great, great entertainments. It is. I've been up there a number of times, and Dana is someone who's sort of an entertainment genius. She became an entertainment genius by founding and starting a thing called the Sugar Shack, where every single woman, I think, except the women I've dated and known, has spent their time at a bachelorette party over the years. And she was on the Phil Donahue show. She was on Oprah. She was on in Time magazine. But her real passion, that was her nightclub. And that nightclub still does exist. But the dancing horse is really her passion. So what I want you to do while you listen to some music or watch the Bears game during this final segment of the show, the Bears postgame show will be on at 10:30, either very celebratory or very angry. The choice is theirs, of course. But here is a tune from the guy you've been listening to a little bit. You'll recognize the song, but this is Joe Alterman from his CD titled Oddly, Oddly, More Cornbread.
Thank you.
That is, and I'm sort of pleased to be introducing him to you, a young pianist with his trio named Joe Alterman. He performed Friday and Saturday at the Winters Jazz Club just across the river here, and he promised that he would be back. He's very talented. Even Adam Phillips, who knows music as well as anybody in this building, really likes the sound of his piano play. He's a young guy. I'm going to play another tune for you. I was going to have Dana Montana on during this segment to talk about her Dancing Horses, but I love Dancing Horses as much as she does. The website is thedancinghorses.com. It is a real, it's a treat any time of year, but they really go crazy during the holiday season. It is a number of, it's a horse show, but the likes of which, whatever you think of a horse show, it is kind of a horse show as done by, you know, Cirque du Soleil or somebody. It is really extravagant with music and water shows and waterfalls and unbelievable costumes, and they do a really amazing kind of holiday show in Lake Geneva. It's just outside Lake Geneva, and Lake Geneva itself is a very pleasant place to experience the holidays. So I'll tell you a little bit more about that, but I'm going to give you some commercials. You'll hear a little bit more from Joe Alterman, and then the Bears postgame show will be coming up on this very station. And right now, I will tell you, you have TVs. You can watch the game and listen to the show at the same time. It looks pretty good. It looks pretty good, and I don't know how joyful the fellows will be, but I certainly prefer them joyful to angry. So I will tell you to watch Mike and Joe. That's Mike and Mater and Joe Donlin weeknights on WGN TV News at 9. I will also tell you that the Steve Cochran Show has free Blackhawks tickets for you Monday at 7:50. So please be listening. I wish I could have told you they have free Super Bowl tickets, but that's still coming. That's still coming. Here come a few commercials, and then we'll play a little bit more of Joe Alterman. As promised, ladies and gentlemen, a little more of Joe Alterman from his strangely titled More Cornbread. Here's I Heard It Through the Grapevine. Or did we play that, Adam? Here is We Heard It Through the Grapevine. You'll love this song. That song is Did You Hear It Through the Grapevine? And my grapevine will tell you that with about 2 minutes and 10 seconds left, the Bears, in possession of that football, are leading the L.A. Rams 15-6. I'm not sure how many people expected that, but you will, if you stay tuned for just a few more minutes, you will have the Bears postgame here and these extraordinarily smart and personable and passionate folks will tell you what it all means. I'll tell you to go to the website thedancinghorses.com to start a new Christmas tradition. It's up in Lake Geneva. You'll get it. You'll get it from the website. Dana Montana runs the place, and she is a showwoman of the first order. So thanks for listening to this abbreviated After Hours. The Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet. Weekday mornings at 720 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. Ben Anderson, thanks for producing. Adam Phillips, what a treat to see you back in the engineering slot. He's the greatest.